This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest is the Washington, D.C. Poet Laureate, Dolores Kendrick. Here she is.
My brother Bob in the kitchen. I watched him in the kitchen tidying up, making metaphors of scraps of paper on the floor, leftovers, glasses needing washing, kitchen counters applying to his eyes for a little polishing. And at that moment, I loved more richly the brother of him that had tidied up a life, that his of him that moved through childhood doing odd jobs after school to keep his manhood clean before it stepped upon dreams and made him sore. The party was settling in, family, all the sweet greetings, bowls and platters, potato salad, chicken, sweet and sour meatballs. Have two, he said to me, knowing the delicacy of our health. We are older now. We are aging. Each morning the light comes as a gift, I think. And I take the extra meatball because he offers it, because he gives it, because his heart meanders sometimes to the pit of his eye and the eye of his voice, because his heart has its own seasons and has told him so, because in 68 years of shortness of breath for him is a sign of valor. In the hospital after the last attack, he fought the air around him for his dignity. They knocked him out so that the medication could do its work. When he revived, the sound of his voice quivered slowly, shook him as if he could find that fading energy in an unwashed dish or the smell of coffee, or something that his kitchen could hear without his touch.
The voice of Dolores Kendrick. I'm Grace Cavalieri. What is the valor in that poem?
I think when he had a great deal of valor in that it was not only that he had gone through a war and suffered because of that war, which was the Korean War, but his valor in his life. He was a man. He started out very young to be a man, and he had his own ethics, his own way of life, and he stuck to it very valiantly, and I respected that in him so much.
Each morning the light comes as a gift. Dolores, is that true?
Well, that's true. I think the older you get, the truer that becomes.
Yeah.
You no longer take life for granted. I remember when I was growing up, which I thought sounds like yesterday, because I thought I was growing up yesterday. I used to think of my mother and my father and those people as being a separate entity. These were the old people. These were the people who were passing on, until I realized one day that it was my turn, that it was my generation. And I respect every morning that comes to me because of that.
This
I think
poem,
it's a gift.
It also points out, what is there to write about? Everything. And what makes this poem is the meatball.
Yeah.
I think it could have gone awry if you hadn't taken that extra meatball.
Yes.
That's what grounds the poem.
Yes, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and
really
that's
did.
What you do in your work.
Yes.
You know that everything is holy.
All right.
And you treat it that way. And then you put a meatball in it and bring us to back to earth.
Yes.
I love that.
Yes.
Let's hear another.
Young girl standing by a post killing herself. Was it the cigarette? Cigarettes kill, but so does falling weather, a late goodbye, a robin whistling on a windowsill. Her youth beguiled her, deceived her, perhaps suggested immortality, languishing in the proper mornings of her body that no sweet, long leaning could fill. She seemed to be tempting her aloneness, a magnifying magnificence of mutual agreements between herself and the killing moment. Something unguarded, frozen, still. I handed her my glance, which she refused, but looked away as she blew smoke, ghosting the glance to ashes ascending through a midday cloud. Then I thought of my little life, smoking against my will.
That's Dolores Kendrick, and she is the author of four collections of poems. The most recent is entitled Why the Woman is Singing on the Corner. And that is a verse narrative, a book long narrative in poems. Her book, Women of Plums and the Voices of Slave Women, won the Annisfield Wolf Award, and it was converted to a play. It was a musical. I believe it was at the Kennedy Center.
Yes, in two places, in Cleveland, at a theater in Cleveland, and also here at the Kennedy Center, we did a show.
And it won the New York New Playwrights Award.
Yes.
Wow. Yes. I've heard the music. It is unforgettable. It may still find other stages. That's what I hear.
Well, it could. Mm-hmm. We are still, you mean other performances?
Yes, I do.
Yes, that's exactly what we're working on now. The CD that you mentioned, the musical part where there are 10 poems that Wall Matthews abstracted and put into music with Alida Green, that is going to be reissued, that CD. It had gotten tremendous reviews all over the country, and it sold out and went out of print for a moment, but they are going to reissue that CD. I'm very happy about that.
Dolores Kendrick is a busy person, and we might say that about a lot of people, but when I think of you bringing poetry to corporate offices, to veterans administrations, to hospitals, to boardrooms, I tell you, Dolores, you're changing the face of what a poet laureate used to be. And so what are you doing in Washington?
Well, that's part of my program of bringing poetry to the people. I want to bring it to the people. I want to rescue it from the elitist barriers that it tends to be sort of captured in at times. I want to bring it out to the people. And going into the workplace is one way of doing it. The other way is working with the students here in Washington. My Poet Laureate Poetry Awards happen every year here, and it's been a very successful program. In fact, this year we've had our most successful program, which we did at the Duke Ellington School. All the students get awards for, and it's underwritten by the Inter-American Bank here, Felix Angel. So we get excellent awards for them and for the best poetry, and we print the poems. Also, I have a program called PIP, which is a Poets in Progress program, which are for poets that have talent but who aren't well exposed. And we do that every year in conjunction with the Folger Library. And that is, we have standing room only most of the time at that particular event. I'm very happy with that. I was a little concerned because we had gotten, it was all women there for a while, but we have two men this year who are applying for it. And it really is a wonderful event to see these talents come of age. They also had their own way of doing things, and we have alums now from that group. I'm going to read a poem called Tuning In. And I wrote this poem after I was out in Colorado and I met a woman who loved horses. And she asked me to visit her one day out in the mountains, she and her mother. She said, "We'll have tea in the mountains and watch my horse dance." And I thought, wow. So it was very mundane. We had an old box. We put real china over the box, and we had a teapot, and we had a radio, and she turned on Mozart. And she got on the horse, and the horse actually danced to Mozart. So I wrote this poem called Tuning In. There was the cold, the drift of autumn straining at the bit, the hardened help of new things beginning to call. "You must see my horse," she said. "Come to the field where he is. Learn him." "Oh," I would have said at another time, "see him, feel his tongue upon your hand as he takes a cookie gently, swallows it into his wide and stubborn teeth, and all the while giving you the eye, something of welcome and curiosity, something to know him by." It was Diana's horse, and her time in the field of the wind. We sat, her mother and I, below the stiff cold and earthen sky, dregs of sun sipping clouds to fleshy reeds and grass, leading to a space where Sienna stood, Diana astride, both breathing the long way in one body, spirits migrating back and forth like the creatures of the air. Let's have tea, her mother said, spreading cloth napkins over a wooden box for a table, china cups to soften our reach, and heavy blankets to keep us warm on the windswept hill, answering Diana's trot, held in the muscle of Diana's skin. In the distance, the mountains watching. The tea was hot, strong and crisp, whispering us calm contentment. Diana's mother turned on the portable radio, and we watched Sienna dance to Mozart, his steps, those of the woman who had given her legs to his, the two of them in tune with the music, the sun, the field, the cold, the air and mountains, the tea, the sniff of rhythms finite before stretching space. They, horse and woman, in apogee, dancing within some high ground, some universe beyond the ordinary that shadows and stuns. They in God, dancing on air without a net.
Dolores Kendrick, we're at the Library of Congress. She's been noted as one of the top 10 African-American poets writing today. And of her, they say, Dolores Kendrick has arrived at that point in her career where she understands exquisitely what she wants to say to you. That was none other than Gwendolyn Brooks with that comment. You've done a lot to keep Gwendolyn alive. And what is your interest in her?
Well, it was her interest in me some years back when we met. And that was in the 60s when I met her in Chicago. And we had become friends ever since that point. When I was teaching at Exeter, I made it a point that to bring her there almost every other year so that the different levels of students would be exposed to her work. But nevertheless, she had me out in Chicago. We reciprocated each other. When she was poet laureate here in Washington, she had started these noontime readings, and she had me at those noontime readings. She was always there for me with my work. I could always send her my work and get a response from her. And we became very, very close friends. Sometimes we just call each other and talk about the chocolate cake that I had sent her because she loved chocolate cake and things like that.
Here's something funny. People think, oh, Gwendolyn Brooks is in every book. She's on every website. She's established. She's world famous. Why do we need to do any more? That's not really the truth.
I don't think that's the truth. Mm-hmm. No, I don't. I go into bookstores today purposefully. I was up in New Hampshire recently, in Concord, visiting a friend, and we went into a bookstore because she said, I want to find out if they have your book. Well, of course they didn't. They just had the books of the poets within that area. But I looked for Gwendolyn Brooks. She's a national poet. She wasn't there. And I have gone into bookstores. I can understand why they may not have Dolores Kendrick, but I find it very difficult to find a note that they do not carry Gwen's work.
First Black Poet Laureate.
There you go.
No, excuse me, Pulitzer also. First Black writer to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Right, and the first Black woman to be a poetry consultant here at the Library of Congress.
Well, this is something that people need to know.
Yes.
Because it takes a poet in existence to be an activist at every moment. In other words, you are an activist.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What was the recent written work you did about her that was a scholarly piece?
They were doing a work on, there was a book out on one of her novels. And they, meaning the University of Chicago State University, and they asked a number of us who were familiar with Gwen and who were close friends to do essays on that particular novel. And so I did. I did an essay in which I dealt with the language and how she was able to use language so beautifully and eloquently. I think the title of the essay was The Eloquence in the Language of Gwendolyn Brooks in this particular novel.
Should be published in its own right.
Right. Oh, thank you. No,
Perhaps it can be.
It was published in this anthology that the Chicago State put out. But that was a wonderful experience for me because I had to look into her bios more efficiently than I'd ever done.
And I know you were huddled.
I learned a lot about her. Yeah.
Huddled down here at the library.
Yes, down in the scholars division, yes.
Working away
day after
day.
Yes, it was quite a thing.
And we are at the Library of Congress again with Dolores Kendrick, and so we're going to go on with your own work.
Okay, this poem is called Pieta Negra and is a poem I wrote after the sculpture of Richmond Barthe, a black woman holding her lynched son in her lap. Now, this business of lynching has come to the surface again, thank God, and somehow the country is reaching an atonement for it. And I wrote this poem back in 1984, so I'd like to read that, called Pieta Negra. Her face is like a hair of noon, which glistens black back into limbs of dreams and bones of her smile, which asks no questions, which is no lie to I, the cold and stingy manger where swaddle lies her shivering child in stiff and steely jaws, claws of his jail cell hovering, which shut like headaches, streets and cities into the body of her brow. For now the comely kings will walk bearing hungry gifts of death and life and absolution, one of a time, the crime of her sweet son, the will to be. What she looks upon she anoints, and yet to let the mother of her gaze die too is much a murder as her deepened dead will, more precise than laws, because she dies alone as he sinks into her lover's lap.
And that is, tell everyone what the Pietà is, the original.
Well, the original Pietà was the Blessed Virgin holding Christ as he was brought down from the cross.
Exactly. Dolores, you are known for something which is pretty rare in poetry. You are a poet now of public art. I can name two others. Richard Wilbur did a piece, a cantata, on the Statue of Liberty, and Rita Dove did a piece on the woman at the dome of the Capitol. Some of your work now is adorning some world-known pieces of art. What are they?
Right, and I think the thing that makes me extraordinarily happy about it is some commissions will ask you to write about a situation, and the poem is separate from the event itself. But in these instances, there were sculptors. The one downtown is Albert Paley's sculpture, and I was asked to collaborate with him on a poem to go into his sculpture. So the poem is written into his sculpture. And down at the, there's a metro stop, the Red Line, where I worked with Barbara Grigurtis. And in both cases, these sculptures are about 25 feet high. And I wrote a poem for the sculpture itself, which is embedded in the sculpture.
That must feel great.
It's so good. And then inside, there's a second poem of mine, which is written in aluminum along the walls of the Metro Center, at the Metro Station. So I'm very, very happy about that, because these things will be there long after I'm gone, you know.
What kind of art is public art?
You know, I think public art, the term explains itself. It's art that is designed to help the public to appreciate art as we know it. And that could be anything. It could be a painting. It could be sculpture. It tends to manifest itself in sculptures and sometimes photography.
But to write a poem about it then is a very daunting thing, because you don't want to trivialize just because it's going to be a populist piece of work. And so does that get into your gray cells and start thinking, oh no, I have to make this poem very mainstream, I have to make it very accessible? How does that affect the poet?
Well, you know, I think, and you may know something about this being a writer yourself, it's a strange process writing a poem. There are about three or four things that are running through your brain at the same time, and it's up to you to digest them and find out how they're going to work. But they're hitting you. They're all hitting you at the same time. And in doing a poem for a sculpture, I have to think of, well, talk with the sculptor. What is his vision? Mm. What is my vision? And how can we help those visions to meet? And in between is the public art message.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful explanation of that.
Yes, thank you.
And did that happen?
It happened. It happened in both cases. It was delightful to work with these artists who are very, very extraordinary sculptors. And we had a good association.
Dolores Kendrick, I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're at the Library of Congress, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're going to hear another poem. This is a new manuscript.
Yes, the poems that I was just reading from is a new, well, it's not necessarily a new manuscript. They're new poems that I have collected, and they may or may not go into my new book.
Do you have a title?
Yes, Settle You.
Settle You.
Settle You.
Your titles are fascinating.
Well, that one fascinated me. I was in a bank one day, and I was waiting to be waited on by one of the assistants, and she had a computer, and on the computer she had pasted one of those little patch paste papers, Settle You, and she had the quote from Peter in the Bible. It comes out of Peter. And it struck me right away, and I just wrote it down very quickly and checked it out, and it comes from Scripture. So I thought, I'm going to use that somewhere.
I love
and
it.
I'm going to use that too as my new book of poetry. I had thought of doing selected poems, but for some reason I was not comfortable with it. I thought everybody, at one point, a poet is going to do selected or collected poems. There's no imagination vision that I was interested in that. I wanted to do something else. And these poems will be a book of poems in which I will explain, first of all, why the poem came into being, how it came into being, and then the poem will be quoted.
There will be a little essay?
Yes, there will be a little paragraph there telling the reader how the poem came into being and
what gave you that idea?
A friend. He was at the University of Maryland, former professor at the University of Maryland, and he suggested that to me. He said, why didn't you do that? Nobody's ever done that before. And I was very fascinated with the idea, so that's what I'm going to do.
Here's another poem.
This one is called The Cleaning Woman, Hattie Elder. Now, this poem I read at the Kennedy Center for the Mayor's Art Awards last January, and I read it with Wal Matthews, who came in from Baltimore and did the music, so we did it with a musical background.
Oh.
It went over so big, not only at the event itself, but with people who had heard it, that I was able to get it done as a broadside when I went to the University of Arizona to read recently. And it's about something that a lot of people are connected with, because not only were the people out at the University of Arizona interested in it, but also at the Kennedy Center, I got calls about it. But also, I read it at the Veterans Administration, and there were a number of people who came up to me and said, Dolores, my mother was one of those people. She put me through school doing that. And I've been fascinated by those women, because when I was here in Washington, D.C., I grew up here, and I used to travel at night. It was quite comfortable to do that, going to friends' houses to study and whatnot. And I used to see these women at bus stops at midnight or so, going into these buildings to clean them. And I thought, man, that is really some kind of a job. But nobody realized that they had a life. And I decided, well, I'm going to write about one and show us that she really had a life. And this is called The Cleaning Woman, Hattie Elder. If you held her, her bones would crack and sink into their skulls like morning frost. You would not know that her body had scrubbed its way into the flesh of the dreams of her husband and children and grandchildren with every swing of the mop or fall of floor that held the footprints of executive suites in cold, bleeding buildings. Or that once she made peace with little impudent dreams that called to her in a language she surely felt, but never completely understood or wanted to know. As she was conflicted and given to odd things, old things, things that predestined her to that of caretaker. But if you dared to touch her, woman of so many years of benign love, the living of which comforted her in pale and impossible moments, you would know her bones and now gnarled hands carried within them a rich and profound blessing that was even too heavy for her to bear. So she was thankful for the skin of her dreams thinning as the days went by. She was thankful. And if you dared to touch her, you would know what she meant as she searched your face like the road leading to her tiny house, the bone and home of it in whatever traveled in your eye. Her tidy floors were her floors. No one else could clean them as well as she, and whoever walked upon them had been blessed by her. She took pride in that, and a certain care that outlasted the pain she felt in her legs and arms and back, and the wheelchair she knew awaited her for her trouble. Sometimes the buildings talked to her, and she talked back, while riding the midnight bus to home, and what there awaited. And you would know, if you dared to touch her, that her presence was what counted, even as her fragile figure beckoned you into a shelter of whatever is permanent, for touching her would expose your mortality. But if you were fortunate, she would direct your eye to a black and golden butterfly, the monarch of the lens of all your fallible senses, and you would see her enter into its wings for a midnight nap, while the executive suites smoldered, brightened, and beckoned in the dark.
Impudent dreams, Dolores? Yes. Did she have impudent dreams?
Impudent dreams, yes. Yeah. So that's a word I borrowed from Gwendolyn. She told me once that I had a certain impudence of language in my poetry. And I love this expression. I mean, it's exciting. It challenges me.
It sure is. Yeah. It's incorrigible. Yeah. And that's what we have to be, is a little bit wild.
We do.
To keep it fresh.
To keep
and
it fresh.
And you did breathe life into an anonymous figure,
yes,
which you are known to do, whether
Thank
it's
you.
A historical person,
yeah,
someone, an anonymous person through history, a woman on the street corner, or a well-known, you are known to rescue women from obscurity.
Thank you. That's where I think I'm going, and have been, yes.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Our guest is Dolores Kendrick, who is the Poet Laureate of Washington, D.C. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're back with Dolores Kendrick. She's the Poet Laureate of Washington, and she has been talking about her new book, which is going to be called Settle You.
Yes.
And it's really amazing. It's very different. You're going down different paths in this book, Dolores.
I will be, yes. I will. Usually I work with themes, but the theme of Settle You will probably filter throughout all of these poems, but they will be different in content.
Here's who she is. She retired as the first Vera Hines Professor Emeritus from Exeter School. And I think you were the first many things there.
Yes, I was the first woman of color to be an emerita at Exeter.
Right.
You remember?
I do.
We're so used to the male.
Yeah, but you changed that.
But I just, you know, we're so used to that male. It's normal for us to say emeritus or emeriti, you know. And then I was the first Catholic, I think, at Exeter to have her portrait painted and placed on the walls at Exeter. I'm the first African American woman to have that happen. The principal's portrait is there and two other women. And I'm the first Catholic to have that happen. I'm the first master teacher to be on those walls. Most of the portraits are of the people who were administrators and founders of the academy. All of them are, except me. I'm the first master teacher to be there.
Is it a pretty portrait?
Oh, it's stunning. Yes, it is. It was done by a very fine artist.
Is this it?
No, that is a photograph that was taken of me.
I'm holding up a brochure from the Smithsonian Institution, Anacostia Museum, where I went to see Dolores featured as a fantastic exhibit of writers, and it was curated by Ethelbert Miller.
Yes.
And she had her own little corner of the museum. It was such fun. You clicked on Dolores, and she came to life and talked to you on this video.
Yeah.
It had a beautiful text, a huge wall-length text of hers. How do you like being famous?
Grace, I don't consider myself as famous. I have to tell you something, and I think you would understand this perfectly because I think you're in the same circuit. If I could have my work known throughout the land, people know my work and read my work without the celebrity, I'd take it overnight.
Oh, we're going to hear more.
This poem I wrote for my mother. I've written several poems for her because she was the dearest and best friend I've had during my entire life, and she was so had a lot to do with how I developed as an adult. And she was a musician. She helped to write the song that put over one of the big singers back in the 40s. And the song was My Heart Beats for You, Billy Eckstein. And she wrote that song with two other people. I had the original Decca record with Earl Father Hines on it and whatnot. So music was part of her life. She loved the intermezzo from Cavalleria Rusticana, and we used to listen to it quite a lot. She loved it. And through now and then she would talk to me about music, and she taught me what transposing is. And I used to become very attracted to transposing, and that's when the music goes up to a different octave. It's pushed up to another octave. And people like Frank Sinatra and Judy Garland and Ella, all those people were very, very good at transposing music. So I wrote this poem for my mother, and it's called Intermezzo. My mother listens to Cavalleria Rusticana. In my mother were operas and poems and sweet ballads floating upon jazz tempos, and she brought me out of her body with the number 7 wrapped around our umbilical cord, a reminder of the surgical severance that never cut clean enough for the navel to reach the ends of the earth she lived in, seated and silenced. Such music embraced her for being so perfect that the comings and goings of pain and unquestioned entities of the spirit merely caused her to comfort those around her who needed to be in her skin and give me air to search and breathe my own seating beyond what I knew or wanted or didn't want or had forgotten. The days went and came like scant November leaves dangling upon backyard juniper trees, songs of sweet a cappellas in burnt umber flowing to the wealth of arias settling within her managed sight and strained pieces of memory, for she knew how to sift the comfortable from the catastrophic, as she knew the patient sound of solos put into her morning breast. Days on end, she ran her fingers over the keys of the piano, as if in the murmurs of music there were some long-lost love hovering in a body of adagios, too sweet to undo. There were things to know. Why swans sing before they die, how crabs prevent themselves from crawling out of a suffocating barrel, where the last firefly went, what old Josiah said before he died, why Grandma Lee was an alcoholic, all the lessons learned and forgotten in the spill of an autumn moon or the scream of a star. It was, for me, to remember the Cavalleria Rusticana as if that opera were the language of women born of men who conceived them after the rib was broken and music took over the world and the histories of smiles and soft illusions. At her dying, she taught me to transpose the deep dust of darkness into unsuspected light and where to pull the key from the original octave and take it higher, somewhere else, into the languishing intermezzo, pulling joyfully at the heart and the edge of the sun sleeve.
Dolores Kendrick at the Library of Congress, I think that could be your Ars Poetica.
You think so?
I really do.
Oh, I'm happy.
It
to
has
hear
so
that.
Much of all of your threads in it. So much. You are such a person of your family.
Yes.
And that family radiated and covered Washington, D.C.
Yes.
in a very important way.
Yes.
As literary people.
Yes.
But I see now the musical connection in the lyricism of your language. I see so much the DNA
yes.
from your mother.
Yes.
It makes such perfect sense.
Yeah, she really had it. She taught music for a while and in the summer school, Catholic summer school, she taught.
And Washington was a place of great gentility
yes.
when you were growing up.
Yes. Well, among Black people, there was...
And you had a very privileged childhood in that the people that came in and out of your houses were people of substance. And
well, this
you
is
talk
true.
About, yeah. You talk about Piper, the Piper
yes.
family.
Yes. He was a Pied Piper, so to speak.
And this gentleman would come into your house and tell you stories.
Yes.
Which... Yes. Ignited you.
Indeed. We would sit at his feet and envision these stories and storytelling. I sort of wish this were popular today. I know that in some cases, libraries and schools bring in storytellers for kids because it incites the imagination. And we would sit and listen to his stories and couldn't wait till Piper came back again. And we'd literally sit at his feet in the kitchen and listen to
him. Do I remember that your father used to play tennis with Sterling Brown?
He did. He and Sterling were great friends. And my father... And he, in those days, there was just one tennis court open for African-American people, but he and Sterling play, and they liked to hold court, both of them. And he used to take me with him on the court, and when my father was losing a point with Sterling, he'd squeeze my fingers and hurt them. I was about 4 years old, and the only thing I remember about Sterling Brown at that point, or tennis, was hurt fingers, bruised fingers, because my dad would lose a point with Sterling.
And here you are following him in the legacy as Poet Laureate of Washington.
Yes.
You're only the second Poet Laureate, Sterling being the first one.
Yes.
And we hope that you are here for a very long time.
Thank you.
Because you're really making inroads.
Thank you very much, Grace.
We had work to do, and you're doing it. Let's have more poetry.
You know the World Trade Building. I remember writing a poem about the World Trade Building some years ago. There was a man who climbed it. He climbed the entire building, and it was really shows you how crazy the world is, because after he climbed it, the police were waiting for him, and at the top, they arrested him. And everybody thought, how ridiculous. This man has done one of the seven wonders of the world, and they're arresting him for climbing the building. Well, I wrote a poem about that, and I also, it was written in lines that resembled the trade buildings themselves. So I'll read this to you. It's called Scaling the World Trade Building. It is high, and he can make it in an era. The windows mount nothing but his dream climbs deep into the universe, touches his belly with a steel star. Grab it, he can. Watch the windows now. They break too under specified pressure. Up past the second floor, then the fourth, fifth, eighth, 11th. Disregard the unnumbered one. 13 doesn't exist in megaphones of power. Touch the 12th, gently. Deeply, as lungs of air come cleaner, purer. Push in blue lumps of height, stiffening eyes to outer worlds of power, where trade is meridian to merchants, hooting like owls, dumb of sight, because as he goes, all fall down. Up, push to the top. The mountain isn't enough. The ache of ascent won't peaceably rise upon rocks and valleys, crevices of storms, high winds and rhythms of the mind. Conscience traded for concrete, plastics, comfortable lighting, of course indirect, the world. See? Humans work in cubicles of solar storms and think that it's a 9-to-5 job. The building now is resilient, moves, sways with him, climbs with him, takes him to its chest, scratches his hunger with fingers that feel like bread to calm his willing appetite. The building is like a mountain. It stands high. Everything becomes its shadow, even its fabric that is rough and without static. How tame his winds are. How much sky there is to be killed. How surly his winds are. How brazen. Dare they whip him from his first love-making to a power living within their own? Are they jealous? No, the mountain is. beyond his grip, beyond the trade of sun kicking through clouds for a world flashing loneliness and sprawls atop Manhattan, touching concrete instead of granite, glass instead of snow, mortar instead of water. He quivers, hesitates. The burn of solar winds turns his scaling inside out, masterminds his stretching neck and arms. Thin stratagems of crumbling curls of air embrace him. Breath that is short now is divided, rationed. A god out there somewhere, waiting for the water in his eyes to fix streams and lakes in high Sierras. Suddenly, he is a high Sierra, coloring daylight in his image, shutting his sight to the climax. His hands are granite, his legs rocks, his feet roots of all that is tall and vulnerable, his toes trees coming of age. The ascent is only as high as he stretches now, fixing himself like a monument upon the top. He watches grids of people pushing ceremonies up into a permanence of stars, and what is natural, what is sweet. He lingers in the universal moment for one terrible, devouring exhaustion, looks about, wonders, believes, unbelieves, knows the climb is his own casualty of hope, knows that climbing creates climbing, not immortality, knows his own communion with the way up has only given him the way down, knows the silence of tricks, the gentleness of giants, the trade of sudden self for small asteroids of honor and the longing of little men.
Climbing creates climbing.
Yes.
That says it all.
Yes.
That is the story of the process of art.
That's right.
Isn't it? Are you telling me that those are about the Twin Towers?
Yes.
And it is written as two stanzas
on the page,
which show themselves to be two towers.
Yes.
Now, I hate to be commercial, but you know, there is a market for that, because that thing looks like the Twin Towers. That should be behind glass, and it should be, I hate to say it, but you could even make money.
Oh, could I?
Really?
Yeah.
In the wake of September 11th,
that
is more immortal than many of the things that are going on.
Oh, yes.
You know.
Yes, thank you.
That's interesting. I had no idea. What book is that from?
This is from Now is the Thing to Praise.
I was thinking about that title today. What is the thing to praise?
I took it from Hemingway, from his book. I think it was For Whom the Bell Tolls. So if your life trades at 70 years for 70 hours, I have that value now and am lucky enough to know it. Now is the thing to praise, and I'm very happy with it. Now, it has a funny sound to be the whole world in your life.
It's all we have.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
The miraculous moment.
Yeah.
There isn't really any past, is there? I mean, well.
I know, Grace. We'll talk about that sometime.
You mean it's a little too deep for
me. I know. I have lots of thoughts on that.
Me too.
Yes.
And the future.
I do believe the past is
it's a place. But you know, what we have that's miraculous is right this second.
Oh, yes.
Second.
Yeah.
And we want more poetry from you.
All right. I'm going to read from The Women of Plums. And the first.
I love this. If this book. Can it still get the Nobel Prize for Literature? Is it too late?
You're so sweet.
Well, that has
happened, you know.
Retrospect?
I think one year, this fellow who wrote the book about the kids.
Is that Robert Cole?
No.
He wasn't a poet.
He wrote this book about the kids on this island. And I've forgotten the name of it. Anyway, he got the Nobel, but that book had been written some years before he got it.
Well, just
and he hadn't written
book.
Anything since, you know, from that time.
Huh.
I don't think they take that into consideration. I don't know.
I wonder how that works. But the fact is that this book is so startling because it is the first of its genre in which you took real slave narratives and made a persona and created a poem from the actual. You fictionalize them sometimes, but you actually took the slave narratives and made poems. And I consider this breaking new ground. So let's hear one.
Okay. I was also getting in touch with my ancestors, too, because part of the time I was hearing their voices, and that had a lot to do with it, and writing things I didn't know anything about.
And you have the courage to say that out loud on the radio. I love that.
Yes. I'll do the one that some people have called my signature poem. That's Peggy and Killy. Okay. This is Margaret Garner, who killed her children rather than have them become slaves. A lot of the slave women did that. And there were several stories about her, and I chose the one that I found doing research in which she kills them. She's escaped from the plantation on a boat. The boat has an accident, and they find her in the water with the children, and she drowns three of them. She drowns them before they get her and put her on the new boat, taking her back to the plantation. And by this time, she has become disoriented. Also, some people have said to me, well, she's like Medea, and I don't like that, because Medea killed out of hatred. This woman killed out of love. And unfortunately, as it was, she is sort of, and she exercises herself. You'll hear her do that. She knows it's wrong. And the only way she can deal with it is to say that she's baptizing the children. So this is Peggy and Killing, traveling. They done found me, Lord. They done found me again. I'm dead and they don't know it. Sometimes I don't either. I'm using her voice. If you can hear it, I'll change the voice there. Except the spirit come creeping in my body like hot fire, and I burn and burn all inside, turn and dust blow away out over their heads when they find me crying in the sack. I listens and listens. I'm traveling in my bones, and the spirit swooshes out before I gets a chance to say amen. Oh, the wind, the sea. I'm dead on this boat. Go away, nigga, they said. So I go. Don't touch me yet. Got to get home to my mother. Ain't that what the Lord said when he rise from the dead, going home to his mother? Won't somebody row this boat out of hell? Can't be no slave forever. Not me and my children, all pretty and soft, all wet in their skin, moist like the sea air they be burning me in. Can't be no slave forever. Make way, Lord. Here I come. Here I am. This here boat they put me on with my children because I tried to escape from their dark breaths, their glories, hallelujahs, their fine houses and sweet fields, their murders, the cunt coughing, stenching in their smiles. They, come here, Peggy, dress my little one and fix something to eat. Maybe some cake and milk. Mine sitting on the stairs in the cold, in the dark, waiting to do some waiting on, waiting for the milk to sour and the cake to crumble. Hearing all this without a word, a whimper, eyes freezing in their dreams, hungers freezing in their dark, taking their dreams to supper like candles melting. And after a while, no more light. They walking softly, making sure they seen and not heard, and the dreams screaming. In their bright, soft eyes, my soft little ones, my children, my Joan and Mary and Lottie, brown and golden black, listening in the dark, bright in they black. But it be a gift, out of their misery I become blacker than the skin of a tree in the rain, and I be rooted in the rich black earth. Out of me flies the swallow. Lord, I'm here because I went with my little ones. We're all going something better. There has to be something better. My death give me a chance. Can't be no slave forever, no Lord. I got wisdom and hope, and I don't think about it, don't believe it, don't not believe it, don't carry them around in my misery like sick animals. Gotta go. Gotta live inside my death like in a wheelchair if I must. There's energy left in that. Caught me in Philadelphia, put me in a boat down in the hollows of his ribs, in the hollering of the sea with my three littles crying to me. No, I lies, they be silent. No tears, no murmurs, no moans, no sighs. And I knew then that death give me a chance, a great salvation, a fine early night. So I waits in the dark and dampness. I sit there till my skin broke and I held my children close. But that boat wasn't meant for nothing but glory. And when it crashed into the sea, I entered that water like I was being baptized. Saw my John's head stretch among the waves, and near him Mary, and near her Lottie laughing. Oh, Lord, what a sight. Baptized to the death. I denounce you, Satan. I denounce this unfree calling. I denounce shackles, bondage, escape, darkness, the quiet of the pain in my throat when I scream for nothing, nothing at all. When I watch my children sit on stairwells in the dark and ice forms in their mouths, I denounce the evil of remembering. I denounce pieces of property, pounds of pain. Nothing be free but the misery. My hands over their heads was such a little matter, just taking them under, putting them there for the water to purify for their own blooming under the sea. Lottie, she kicked a bit, but that be all. It be over. They be flowers in the water now, yes. Lord, how cleansed I be when the water come rushing, beating against my bosom through me to them. I feel like I be given suck, and the wind be my milk, and my healthy babies be fed and wholesome and warm forever. I'm here now. In this place. Don't know it, but it moves, and there be water about another boat. I can see a tiny window, but the light hurts and wants the dark. now and then some peoples come and look at me and ask me if I wants to eat, gives me some cornbread and cold tea. There'd be crates and trunks here, like t'other boat, and I think we'd be moving. They found me in the water, I reckon. Brought me again in a backward time. I'm dead. I know it because I'm happy. The chilling of flowers now, baptized in joy and hope. I shiver when I think of their beauty. Can't cry because I be dead. This old top around me, my flesh rotten, my bones drying out, my eyes moving through some kind of cheesecloth like a fog. I'm going to reach out now, soon, so my death would stay away from my babies. Can't upset them now. They is pure. And these ghosts that come and watch me in the night, I'll sing to them like a star.
The Women of Plums in the Voices of Slave Women. Poems in the Voices of Slave Women. That's back in print, thankfully.
Yes, yes. And it never was out of print. Just before it was about to go out of print through Morrow, Phillips Exeter Academy Press picked it up, so it never really has gone out of print.
People can go order that at the bookstore.
They can order that, yeah, yes. Politics and Prose is the place that usually handles all my books and whatnot.
We'd love to hear another one from that book.
All right. This is Emma in Deafness. It's one I rarely read. I thought I'd read it especially for you today, Grace. Ain't heard nothing in years. There be dreams, too many of them, too awful of them, too teary and peppery. I takes the bad ones first, then the good. Gives me a balance, helps me to remember what I can't when I see folks moving their mouths all over me till I sneaks out of myself and leaves my shadow for them to talk to. The good dreams be safe and honest, and I don't mind taking them to bed and with me instead of my Joshua, who is long gone, sold to some other plantation. Wonder if he remembers me. Wonder if he takes my murmuring to bed with him still. He used to call me easy girl. I can read signs, because I'm so easy to be with, so easy to talk to. Can't talk back. He knowed that all along. Never cruel about it. Just give me honey to lick and call me another name, sweet tongue, because he knowed I had one. Always licked the honey from his hard brown hand. Miss my Joshua. Miss myself sometimes, though I make me up in sweet ginger mornings that laugh back at me when folks give me orders that don't make sense. Don't make sense to sneak around and watch Liza Lilly make love to Massa like she be his wife. Don't make sense to know he love her back and give her silks and fine shoes while Miss suspect me to give her signs that things be different. Don't make sense to know too much anyway. Or see too much, or moan too much, or even smile too much. Moon don't make sense when it be out there bothering me with its spells and whispers. Yes, I hears the whispers all the time. And my deafness teases me on my tongue, gives me sounds larger than my ears, takes all the nothings away, and the dumbness speaks, and I hear its sweet cry. I knows much that ain't ever going to know me better. I see lips moving, and they sounds run round me like a great shower, cleansing me in a natural way, keeping me busy. I make up my own commands. Emma, be happy. Emma, give praise. Emma, sing. Emma, cuss the devil. And I make my own complaints, too, while all those faces, rubbery and pasty, follow me around all day long. But I be still. No sense murdering what I ain't heard.
Oh. How did you ever get in touch with her?
I don't know. I usually would sit down with a blank piece of paper. That was when I was at Yaddo, and I had read several, because some of them are composite of several of the narratives. And I'd just say, who are you? Because I didn't want to, and I'd wait for the voice to come, and then I'd start moving with it. Sometimes they didn't come, or sometimes they weren't the true voice, and I had to abandon the poem and whatnot.
I love the litany of don't make sense, yeah. Don't make sense, this doesn't make sense. And that, I just thought, this person is being channeled, clearly being channeled.
Yeah.
So it is very hard to explain to students how that happens. You sort of have to set that aside and teach the creative process differently, because there's no way who can explain how a historical figure or a made-up person can occupy your body and talk through you.
Well, this is true. Also, I found myself writing words and language that I didn't know. Like Peggy says, I'm lying here with this top around me, and I kept thinking, top, what's she talking about? And I finally look in the dictionary, and I found out she was talking about tarpaulin. And several other instances in which that happened. So I was quite aware of that. But I love it when this Emma says she leaves her shadow for them to talk to. I think that's wonderful.
And you're talking about your own self, yeah. You know. You can't compliment your own line. My favorite with the Peggy poem is Lottie, She Kicked a Bit.
Yes.
Wow, that one just... Yeah. You always have one line in every stanza that has light around it.
Thank you.
Just really sends it singing, ringing home.
Yes.
And we are so made better by that book, Women of Plums. I know that every time you write a book, you transcend the last, but I think that this one we have not heard the end of yet.
I hope so. I think so, Grace. It's taken on a life of its own, and it's being taught in various and sundry schools around the country. I know it's being taught at Yale. I was told that. But I think it's taken on a life of its own, and that's good. That's good for...
Well, could we have a little bit more?
This is called Jenny in Love. She's a slave woman, and she's in love. And listen to what she tells you. She's feisty. Danced in the evening while the supper burned. Whooped in the morning. Danced again.
Could we have a little bit more? Could we have either a poem from that book or any other goodbye poem you want to leave us with?
Let me read the introductory poem to Plums, because some people like that book, mm-hmm. that poem. Mm-hmm. And it's...
Who does it feature?
It's called Canticle of a Black Lady, and it says, dying asks a question, she gives an answer. This is where the title Women of Plums comes from. Done, every ounce of it. Fly winds to sea rocks and break around a prayer upon their backs. Turtles take notice. You may walk with your eyes upright. Beasts in the forest part the noon with your cries. Stretch your bones into the sun. Embrace amen as you eat the air. It is done. Said, pronounced, motioned, spoken, astonished. The men of oranges have shared their skins, and their flesh is puffed upon weeds. The women of plums are sweet and black. Their flesh is moist with tears of joy. Their skins, their dreams are skins the color of dusk. Mm. Their ripe dreams, bitten into, leave a sour sweetness in the membranes of the mouth. The children of quince quiver in the womb. Their eyes are dowries, their tongues soft songs. And the bride comes forth, carrying peacocks upon her fingers, bearing roses in her hair. She comes forth beyond the wedding day and speaks, I will, and amen.
The voice of Dolores Kendrick. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media. Post-production by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. The Witterbinner series is brought to you by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C., the National Endowment for the Arts, because a great nation deserves great art, and the Witterbinner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear this series on www.loc.gov/poetry. We wish to thank the Motion Picture, Broadcasting, and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. Our engineer is Bill Haley. I'm Grace Cavalieri.